Okay, good morning. This shiur, the weekly shiur, is from Masechet Sukkah, sponsored by Yitzway CPA. Shake things up a bit this tax season, and breakfast is sponsored by Bagel Munch in honor of Hamie's granddaughter. We are starting a new parak today. We're on the Amud Beis of Daf Chaf Amud Beis, at the very beginning of the second parak of Sukkah, and we're going to start at the Mishnah. So the Mishnah talks about a situation of someone who is a yashen tachas hamita b'sukkah, someone who sleeps underneath a bed in his sukkah. So we know that the whole idea of a sukkah is the schach has to be over you. And the question is, if you are under the schach, but there's a big impediment in between you and the schach, there's a bed, you're sleeping under your bed, does that, we could call it a chatzitza, we could call it some kind of interruption between you and the air of the sukkah and the air of the schach, does that present a problem? So the Mishnah starts off by saying right off the bat, Hayashen tachas hamita b'sukkah lo yatzo yidei chovaso. It doesn't work. You cannot sleep under your bed under the sukkah because the bed is too much of an interruption between you and the schach. But that's not the end of the story. So that's the Tanakhama. Amrav Yehuda, Noagim hayinu, our minag was shayinu yishenim tachas hamita bifnei hazakenim. We would sleep under a bed in the sukkah in front of the zakenim. The elders saw us doing that. V'lo amru lanu davar. No one said anything, implying that it's perfectly acceptable to sleep under a bed in a sukkah. You're yotze the chiyuv of sukkah by doing so. And furthermore, Amar Rabbi Shimon, Maisa betavi avdo sho Rabbi Rabban Gamliel. So Tavi, the slave of Rabban Gamliel, Shayyoshen Tachas Hamita, he would sleep in the sukkah, under a bed. Now, an Eved, and this is an Eved Kenani, so what's the halacha of an Eved Kenani? Is he mechuyav in mitzvos? He's basically in the category of a woman. He's pater from mitzvos asei shazman grama, any kind of time-bound mitzvos, the Eved is pater from. So therefore, an Eved is not chayav in the mitzvah of sukkah. And so Rav Shimon is relating that the Tavi, the slave of Rabban Gamliel, would sleep in a sukkah, but he would sleep under a bed. V'yamar lehen Rabban Gamliel is zakenim, and Rabban Gamliel would tout this to the zakenim. Rabban Gamliel would say this to the chachamim. Reisem Tavi Avdi, check out my slave Tavi, shu talmud chacham. He was known to be a very wise and learned slave. He was a talmud chacham. V'yodeya shavadim patur min ha-sukkah, and he knows that avadim, that slaves, are patur from the mitzvah of sukkah. V'fichach yashenu tachas hamita, and that's why he's sleeping under the sukkah. He's sleeping in the sukkah davka, not to be yotze the mitzvah of sukkah. Again, implying that a bed is an impediment to being fulfilling the mitzvah of sukkah. Sleeping under a bed is not okay. And from that story, we learn Shayashin Tachasamita Oyatse de Chavaso. Rabbi Shimon concludes his statement by saying, from the story of Rabbi Gamliel, who would boast about the fact that his slave would sleep under a bed in order not to be Yotze the mitzvah of sukkah, we learn from there that sleeping under a bed doesn't work. So again, the Mishnah started with the Tanakhama saying it doesn't work. Then we had Rabbi Yehuda, the minority opinion, saying that we used to sleep in the sukkah and no one said anything about it, implying that it does work. And Rabbi Shimon telling the story of Tavi, who Davka slept in a sukkah under a bed in order not to be yotzei the mitzvah of sukkah. Now, the immediate question that you think about is, why did Tavi go out of his way not to be mekayim in the mitzvah of sukkah? Even though it's true that an Eved is not chayev in mitzvah asei shazman grama, we know that our women sleep in, they might not sleep in the sukkah, but they eat in the sukkah, right? Even though they're not mechuyavos, and they come to shul to your shofar, and they do mitzvah sasei shazman grama all the time, because you're allowed to do a mitzvah sasei shazman grama even if you are not mechuyavos in it. So the same should be true for an eved. Why would Tavi go out of his way not to be mekayim in the mitzvah of sukkah? So Tosfos quotes Yerushalmi here, that in fact points out that Tavi himself would put on tefillin every day. Tefillin is also mitzvah sasei shazman grama, right? And so he's not chayv in putting on tefillin. So why would he go out of his way davka to not be mekayim the mitzvah of sukkah? And Tosfos explains that the idea here was that their sukkahs were crowded, and Tavi didn't want to sleep in the main part of the sukkah, so he put himself under the table specifically, because that's where no one else would be sleeping. All the other chachamim who had to be mekayim in the mitzvah of sukkah, they would sleep in the other parts of the sukkah. Tavi squirreled himself under the table so as not to push them out and take up room. And Tosfos ends up by saying he didn't want to sleep outside of the sukkah, or he didn't want to sleep in the house, because he wanted to hear their divrei Torah. I guess as they were kind of dozing off and going to bed, they would share some divrei Torah. So Tavi wanted to be there in the action. But the way he accomplished that was by sleeping under the bed so he wouldn't take up room in the sukkah, wouldn't crowd out the chachamim. But the story still stands, meaning from Tavi's actions and from the fact that Rav Gamliel touted the fact that his slave slept under a bed in the sukkah, that demonstrates this idea that the Tanakhama held of, that lo yotze yidei chavasa, that sleeping under a bed, you're not yotze, the mitzvah of sukkah.
Why would anybody want to sleep under a bed?
Why would you want to sleep under a bed? Well, Tavi did it because that was where there was space to sleep. Regular person, maybe you have a bad back, and your mattress is too soft, and you want the hard concrete patio floor of your sukkah. Okay. Or maybe you're afraid it's going to rain in the middle of the night, and you figured that's a good way of being mechayim in the mitzvah of sukkah. You get a little shelter. Think of it not only as a bed, but think of it as, I mean, we're going to talk about how it's specific to a bed, but even just a canopy of some sort that you're sleeping under in the sukkah to protect you from the elements. So is that a problem? Is that a chatzitza? Do you need the undiluted or direct, you need to sleep directly under the schach, or can there be something in between? So that's the Gemara now is
so
going to just qualify this.
If somebody sleeps in the sukkah and is using a blanket, that's also a chatzitza.
Yes, exactly. So this is a good point. So we already dealt with this in the Gemara on Daf Yud. How does it work? Like, what's the difference between a blanket and a canopy and a bed? So we said, in fact, back on Yud, we were talking about beds with canopies. You can sleep on top of the bed, but with a canopy on top of you. And the test there was the first line of the Gemara here. The Gemara is going to clarify here. Gemara says, Valeka asara. Why should sleeping under a bed be a problem as long as there's not a gap of 10 tfachim? So it should be as if it doesn't, as if it kind of collapses to a blanket. Meaning a blanket's not a problem because there's no gap of 10 tfachim. Mm. It's not a canopy. A canopy
it's
is
as if it's
there's
you,
10
it's,
tfachim.
It's
if it's right against you, then it's not a problem. And in fact,
like
a canopy that's less than 10 tfachim is like a blanket because it's kind of buttled to you. There's no gap between you and the thing, and therefore that's like a blanket.
Mm-hmm.
The bed becomes a problem only at 10 tfachim. The canopy becomes a problem only at 10 tfachim. A blanket, for that matter, will become a problem at 10 tfachim.
Mm-hmm.
There's another criteria we talked about on Daf Yud, whereas it has to have a tefach at the top. If it is like a teepee and doesn't have any kind of width at the top, then that's also going to not be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about whether you can say Kriya Shema, let's say a person's not clothed, and he's under a blanket, or he's not clothed, and he's in a canopy. So to what extent does the canopy count as clothing so that he can now say a Kriya Shema? If his head is sticking out from under the canopy, and the canopy is covering him, but he's not clothed, can he say a Kriya Shema? And it's determined by the same test. If it's more than 10 tfachim, is it less than 10 tfachim? If it's less than 10 tfachim, it's like clothes. If it's more than 10 tfachim, then it's like its own structure. If it has a tefach at the top of width, then maybe it's considered its own structure, whereas if it's a teepee, then maybe it's considered more like clothing. And so the same tests are going to apply here, and the Gemara immediately says, Valeka asara, if this bed doesn't have a height of asara of 10 tfachim above you, then it shouldn't present a problem. And the Gemara clarifies, Tirgum Shmuel, the mita asara. We're talking about specifically a bed that has a height of 10 tfachim above you, and that's when it becomes a chatzitza and becomes its own structure and becomes a problem. But Nir Nachinami, if it's less than 10 tfachim, then it's no different than a blanket, and that would be okay. So we could stop right there in terms of halacha, meaning the Tanakhama paskind, you're not yotzei the mitzvah of sukkah if you have a bed above you. Shmuel clarified we're talking about a bed that's at least 10 tfachim off the ground. I think the Rishonim grapple with it, whether it's off the ground or off your chest, but 10 tfachim. And based on that, the Shulchan Aruch paskins, Hayashen tachas hamita besukkah, someone who sleeps under a bed in a sukkah, im hi gavo asar tfachim, lo yatza. If it's 10 tfachim, Mishnah Berurah says, mina aretz, tachtis hamita, from the ground until the lowest part of the, you know, till the base of the bed, then, and if that if that elevation is 10 tefachim, lo yotze, you're not yotze the mitzvah of sukkah. That's as far as what the halacha is. But the Gemara now is going to get into a long discussion about the minority opinion in this Mishnah, which is Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda, if you remember, says that you can sleep under a bed, and presumably it means even a bed that's 10 tefachim. He says we used to do it all the time, and no one said anything to us, implying that it's perfectly permissible. And now we're going to delve into how do you explain Rabbi Yehuda in light of other statements Rabbi Yehuda made. So that's what the Gemara is going to do now. And we're going to get into a tangent of Hilchos Tumah and Tahara and Ohel for about a Amud, and then we're going to, based on that, kind of deep dive into Hilchos Ohalos. We're going to, on Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, about 10 lines down, we're going to circle back to Rabbi Yehuda and challenge Rabbi Yehuda. So set aside for a moment Hilchos Sukkah, and we're going to get into the world of Tumah and Tahara, but it's a really interesting discussion here, we'll see. So the Gemara says, Tanan Hasam, we have a Mishnah that says there, a Mishnah in Olos. Echad Chor. So when it comes to Olos, we know there's a general mitzvah, a general concept in Tumah and Tahara, that if you have a dead body in a room, let's say there was a dead body in this room, we would all become Tamei Meis by virtue of the fact that we're within the same structure. So a Kohen, for example, is not allowed to be in this room if there's a dead body in it, because the dead body is contained within the same structure. And the Mishnayos and Olos talk about what's considered a structure. Does it have to be a man-made structure? Can it be a natural structure? Could the structure be? What's it made of, etc. So the Mishnah says in Olos, Echad Chur Shecharuhu Mayim Oshratzim. Let's say you have a naturally made, crevice. So let's say you have a naturally made crevice. You can imagine like a side of a riverbank, a river, the water rushes by, and it kind of carves a crevice at the bank of the river so that there's like a little cave kind of at the side of the bank, and you could, you know, hide under that cave. So that is an ohel in a sense, because it's got a covering. If there was a dead body in that crevice on the side of the river that was carved out by the river naturally, and you're there, or you become Tamei Meis by virtue of being in that same structure. So let's say the water carved it out, or Shrutzim, let's say there were like beavers there, some kind of sheretz that carved it out. O she'achalaso maleches, or salt corroded a certain area. You have like, you can imagine like by a beach where there are salt deposits, and the salt somehow over time corrode something to make it like a natural hole. V'chein midbach avanim, and similarly a structure that's created by large boulders. Let's say you have a bunch of large boulders by like the side of the ocean, and they create a natural cave, a natural crevice. So that's another example of v'chein suar shel koros, or let's say you have a pile of beams. You didn't intentionally structure the beams in a way to make a cave, but you just dropped a bunch of beams, and it turns out there are crevices under those beams that create a natural ohel. So all of those things are mahil al hatumah. Those are considered an ohel. Just because it wasn't built by a builder doesn't mean that it's not an ohel. And if there's a dead body under that structure of beams, or under that naturally carved out salt deposit, or thing that the water carved out on the side of the riverbank, all of those things will be considered an ohel. If there's a dead body under that and you're under it, you become Tamei Meis by virtue of being in the same ohel. That's the Tanakama. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, however, Ko ohel, she'ino asli bidei adam, eino ohel. Rabbi Yehuda has a rule that says that it's not considered an ohel in order to transmit Tumah unless it was man-made. So this room would work, because this was built by builders, and if a dead body was in here, and you're in here, you're Tameh. But on the other hand, if you find yourself at, you know, the side in that crevice by the river that was carved out by running water with a dead body, that's not going to make you Tameh, according to Rabbi Yehuda. And just to clarify, Rashi points out, Bidei Adam means miskaving lasoso ohel, where the person intentionally made the ohel. So for example, the example the Tanakhama gave, where you dropped a bunch of beams. So that's man-made technically, because the person dropped a bunch of beams, but he didn't do it with the intent of making a structure. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, that wouldn't be considered an olah. It's only considered an olah according to Rabbi Yehuda if a person intended to make it a structure. So the Gemara says, my time is Rabbi Yehuda. Why does Rabbi Yehuda have this limitation? Why is it only an intentionally created man-made structure that creates an OL? Yolef OL OL mi mishkan is a gezer shava of two psukim where the word OL is used. Ksiv hacha zos ha-torah adam kiyamos ba-OL. In this parsha where we're talking about tuma transmitting through an OL, through a tent, through a structure, it says OL. Uksiv hasam vayifrosh esa oel ala mishkan, that they covered the mishkan with the skins. Malalon bidei adam, so just like by the mishkan, that was clearly an intentional creating of a structure. Afkan bidei adam, so too here, the only ohel that creates tuma, that's going to transmit tuma, by virtue of it being a structure, is a structure built intentionally by a person. That's Rabbi Yehuda's rule. What did the Rabbanan do with that? Gzer Shava, Rabbanan, OL, Riba. The Rabbanan say, OL, there, that is just to kind of include all sorts of OLM. He kind of understands the drasha the opposite way Rabbi Yehuda was, not as a limitation to say only man-made structures, but as a Riboy, as to include all sorts of structures, like Mishkan or like any other thing. Okay. So that's Rabbi Yehuda's rule. Only an intentionally made man-made structure will transmit Tumah. So the Gemara immediately challenges that. And it challenges it I'll just introduce it. Paraduma is right, the way you become tahor from tumas meis is with the paraduma. The Gemara the Torah in Parshas Chukah says that the way you get rid of tumas meis is by burning a paraduma, and then taking the ashes and putting it in water and mixing it, and then you sprinkle the water, and then you wait 7 days to go to the mikveh, etc. So that's the way. That's how paraduma works. Now paraduma, generally speaking, has to be prepared. The ashes have to be prepared bitara. They have to be prepared by people who are not tame. But there are different levels of tuma. And there are different levels of tuma both when you get into the tuma and when you're coming out of the tuma. So for example, when you're coming out of the tuma, a person goes to the mikvah. And then once he comes out of the mikvah, he's considered a tful yom. But he's not yet tahor until, this is from certain types of tuma, he's not yet tahor until the sun sets. And even after the sun sets, he kind of has a different level of tuma, so that he can now eat truma, but he still can't eat kudshim until he brings karbanos on the next day. So there are three different stages. There's the point in time where the person goes to the mikvah, he then becomes a tful yom. He can now he can eat meiser sheni. But he can't eat truma yet until the sun sets. Once the sun sets, he can now eat truma. And now he still can't eat kudshim until he brings his karbanos. So the next day when he brings his karbanos, he goes to the mikvah again, midrabanan, but at this point now he could eat kudshim, right? So the kind of different dargas, different levels to become tahor. Now the tzedukim, remember they were the ones who interpreted Torah Shivachsav literally in many instances, so they thought, or they were convinced, that you can't prepare the ashes for a paraduma unless you're completely tahor. You know, until like after the sun sets, maybe you have to bring karbanos. But they believe that you couldn't do it as a tful yom, meaning just going to the mikvah was insufficient to render you tahor to prepare the ashes of the paraduma. But the tzedukim were wrong, and Chazal felt very strongly that a tful yom, someone who just goes to the mikvah, is sufficiently tahor, sufficiently pure to create the ashes for the paraduma. And so they specifically, at the time that the paraduma was prepared, they would specifically make that person tamei and then have him go into the mikvah to demonstrate to everyone that even a tful yom, even someone who's at that earliest stage of tahara, just someone who's gone to the mikvah, is sufficiently tahor to prepare the ashes of the paraduma. They did that to kind of shtuch the tzedukim, to show everyone that tzedukim were wrong. A tful yom may prepare the ashes of the paraduma. But then Chazal realized that we're kind of playing with fire here. We're sending a message to the people that a tful yom can prepare the ashes of the paraduma, but now people are going to maybe not take the rules of paraduma so seriously, and they're going to think that all sorts of other things are also permissible that are not permissible with the paraduma, and so they were very machmir. They kind of, as a reaction to this, they became very machmir in all the rules of paraduma, and they imposed all sorts of stringencies by paraduma that don't apply min haTorah, just to counteract the imposed kula that they did to demonstrate to the tzdukim that a tful yom can prepare the ashes of their paraduma. And one of those stringencies was that the water that you'd mix the ashes for the paraduma with was specifically gathered from the Meshiwach, from the river that ran through Yerushalayim, by ketanim who couldn't yet have ever become zavim, right? You can only become a zav if you're older than, you know, the age of puberty. And so they would have ketanim, young boys, gather the water in order to prepare the ashes of the paraduma. And not only that, they had a specific community of young boys that would grow up in an area that had no trace of Tumas Mace at all. And so even though, generally speaking, in parts of Yerushalayim, you'd have to worry that maybe you were walking over a cemetery or walking over an area where the Tumas Mace was buried, they had a specifically designated area where these kids would grow up. And those kids were the designated kids to gather the water in order to prepare the paraduma. And not only that, but these kids, when they traveled from that area where they grew up, where there was absolutely no Tumas Mace, to the area where they would gather the water, they would travel on something that would be mafsik, that would create an interruption between any Tumah below them. Because, right, they were in an area where there was absolutely no Tumas Mace. Other areas of Yerushalayim, they were worried that maybe there was Tumas Mace there. Maybe there was a dead body buried there from years before. And so when they would transport these kids from the, you know, clear zone where there was absolutely no tumah to the water, in between they were afraid they would go over a place where there was tumah, and so they would have them go on some kind of barrier that would interrupt any tumah from below to them, and then only once they got to the water they would kind of dip their cups into the water to grab the water and use that water to prepare the paraduma water. Now again, this was not required, but it was a stringency in order to counteract the practice of Chazal of Davka having a tful yom, someone who was tamei and only partially tahor, prepare the ashes of the paraduma. So with that long introduction, let's see what this, what the challenge to Rabbi Yehuda is. The Gemara says, V'savar Rabbi Yehuda, ko ohel she'eno asui bidei adam eno ohel. Is it true that Rabbi Yehuda holds? Oh, wait, just one more point of introduction. Generally speaking, the rules of Ohel, the rules of what's considered a structure. So until now, we've been talking about what's considered a structure so that if you have a dead body and a person within that structure, the Tumah transmits. But the same rules will apply for a structure that's Mafsik Tumah. So meaning, this room is an Ohel, we said, because it's man-made, and so even Rabbi Yehuda is going to hold it's an ohel, so that if there's a dead body in this room and a person in this room, the tumah would transmit. But that same rule, the same criteria for what's considered an ohel, what's considered a structure of significance, will determine what kind of ohel will interrupt tumah. So if you remember a moment ago, we said that these kids would go from the clear zone to the water on top of something that would interrupt any kind of tumah below them to the tumah above them. So the same rules are going to apply to determine what's a structure that interrupts tumah from flowing upwards. So the Gemara says, V'savar Rabbi Yehuda kol ol she'eno asui bidei adam eino ohel. Is it true that Rabbi Yehuda holds that in order for it to be considered a significant, a meaningful structure to cause tumah to transmit, and for that matter, to interrupt tumah from going up, it has to be man-made? Is that really true? Viraminhu, we have a contradiction to that from the following. And here we're going to describe the paraduma situation we just described. Chatzeros hayu bnuos Yerushalayim agabe hasela. There were certain areas or neighborhoods or courtyards that were built in Yerushalayim on top of a rock. V'tachteam chalal mipnei karef hatom. And there was a gap between those rocks and the ground beneath them in order to interrupt any kind of tumah from coming upwards in case some dead body was buried underwards. And that's the place where they would raise these kids. So that there was a clear interruption between any kind of tumah below and where these kids were raised above. Umavian nashim ubros violdos ubro. I'm sorry. Umavian nashim ubros violdos sham. They would bring pregnant women. The pregnant woman would give birth there. Umagadlus b'neim sham upara. And they would raise their kids there in that neighborhood in this clear zone that had absolutely no tumah because there was a gap between the rock that this neighborhood was situated on and any kind of tumah below, so the tumah wouldn't go above. It would like it be an ohel underneath, and that's where they raised those kids. And then when it came time to gather the water for the paraduma, umavian shvarim, they would bring oxen to transport these kids to the water where they would get the water, v'algabean dlasos, and they would put doors, they would lie doors on the back of the oxen, v'tinokos yoshvin algabean, and these kids would sit on top of the door. Apparently it wasn't good enough to just sit on top of the ox. They would have a door on top of the ox, laying down. The kid would go on top of the door, on top of the ox, Vikosos shel evin biyadem, and they had stone vessels in their hands. Higiu l'shiluach, when they came to the river of Shiluach, yardu l'toch hamayim, they would get down from on top of the ox, umilgum, and they would fill the vessels with water, vi'alu v'yoshvu lahem, and then they would go back onto the ox and sit on the door, and then they would, you know, continue on to the place where they would prepare the paraduma. The purpose of these oxen covered by a door was to create some kind of interruption between the kid on top and any kind of tumah on the ground below.
It could also be that the oxen was able to transport more than one kid.
There was more room
on that door.
I guess so. That's right. But the significance of these doors and the oxen specifically, the reason they had this wacky way of transporting these kids from their queen zone to the water was in order to protect the kids from any tumah that they would pass over. Okay, that's what would happen. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi, now he's just getting into a technicality about how they would gather the water. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Mimikomo Hayim Mishal Shul Mamali Mipnei Kever Atom. Rabbi Yossi said they didn't actually climb down from the shore in order to get the water. They were still worried about tumah in this area, so they would kind of like lean their cups down from the door. They wouldn't get down into the water. Fine. Okay. And now here's the punchline. V'tanya, we have a brisa that says, Rabbi Yehuda says, lo hayu mevi'in d'lasos el shvarim. Rabbi Yehuda says, they didn't actually put doors on the back of the oxen. They would just sit on the oxen directly. So the Gemara says, this is a problem. Because if Rabbi Yehuda holds that the only thing that's considered an oel, a significant structure that should now be chotzeis mifnei atumah, that should stop tumah from rising, is a man-made structure, how is this going to work? Vashvarim de ohel she'eno asui b'dei adamu. These oxen are not man-made, right? Men don't make oxen. God makes oxen. And so it might be that the kid on top of the ox is now shielded from the tumah, theoretically, but how does that work? Because the only thing that's really going to shield a kid from tumah is a man-made structure. So the door thing makes sense. That'll work. How can Rabbi Yehuda, specifically Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbi Yehuda who taught us that only a man-made structure interrupts tumah from flowing, that the kids wouldn't sit on a door, they would sit on the ox directly? That's a terrible thing, because the ox now is going to go over the tummy area and the tumah is going to go up and infect the kid with tumah. And how's that going to work? V'katani Rabbi Yehuda Omer, lo hayu mevi'in d'lasos el shvarim. What are we going to do? Rabbi Yehuda was the one who says that it has to be man-made, and yet Rabbi Yehuda is the same one who says they wouldn't sit on doors, they would sit on the oxen directly. Okay, so that's the question. So the Gemara answers, ki asa Rav Dimi Amar Rav Elazar, moder Rabbi Yehuda kimlo egrov. He says, Rabbi Yehuda, it's true, has a rule that only a man-made structure is significant enough to stop tumah from going or to be considered an ohel in any respect. But Rabbi Yehuda makes an exception for kamlo egrof. If it's a naturally made substance or naturally made things, but it's bigger than a fist, so then that has significance. So we have to modify Rabbi Yehuda's rule. Meaning Rabbi Yehuda says, if it's a thin item, it's going to be considered an ohel to transmit tumah or to be mafsik tumah, to stop tumah from transmitting. That's only if it's a thin thing. If it's a thin thing, then it's only going to work if it's a man-made thing. But if it's a thick thing, thicker than a fist, which is not that thick, right? A fist is only this thick. As long as it's thicker than a fist, so then it will work as an ohel to transmit toma, to interrupt toma, even if it's naturally made, as long as it's a fist. And so therefore, these shvarim, an ox is thicker, right? It's wider than a fist. And so therefore, Rabbi Yehuda didn't require the door on top of the ox. It was sufficient for the kid to sit on the ox itself. That would interrupt the tumma from going up, and the kid wouldn't become tame by virtue of passing over an area that might have included dead bodies. Tanya Nami Hachi, and we have a brace that's consistent with this. Umod Rabbi Yehuda Bishakifin. Rabbi Yehuda agrees when it comes to caves, uvinikike aslaim, and kind of holes or cavities in boulders. Because those are naturally constructed, because they're bigger than a male egrof, bigger than a fist, that works as an ohel to transmit tumma, to interrupt tumma, and so that's Rabbi Yehuda's modified rule. The Gemara then is going to get into a discussion about why did Rabbi Yehuda think that it was a good idea to get rid of these doors? Like, okay, it's now we understand why it works, but why Dafka did Rabbi Yehuda not want the doors there? So the Gemara says, the Gemara is a little choppy here for a line, and there's a Machlokas Rashi tells us exactly how to read it, but basically he's saying, Vare Delas, Deish Bakama Egrofim, Delas is wide enough to be an Egrof. Tosus points out, well, you don't even need the Egrof, you don't even need the fist thing, because the Delas is man-made. The point is, the Delas is man-made, the Katani Rida Omer Loyum Vien Delasos El Shvarim. Why was Rabbi Yehuda insistent that they not bring the Delasos? Meaning, what's the downside to bringing the Delasos? So Amar Abayi Lahutzruchu Avi Delasos. Abayi modifies it and says, all Rabbi Yehuda is saying is that they didn't need to bring the Delasos, but they might have brought the Delasos, and as Ezra's pointed out, maybe that was even a better way to do it. You could transport more than one kid on top of one shore. You could put seats on these Delasos, you know, however they built them. But Rava says, the Rava Amar Lohayu Mevi'in Delasos Kol Ikar. Rava says, actually, no. Rabbi Yehuda said they dafka didn't bring delasos. They wouldn't put these kids on doors that were on the shore. They would put them directly on the shore for a reason. Why? Because a kid has a lot of self-confidence. A kid is not worried that he's going to fall off the ox, right? An adult, we're all kind of squeamish and we worry. We're all going to hold on tight. Kids kind of, you know, are relaxed. Their daito shotina gasalov shema yotzi rosho echad meivarov v'yitame bekevratom, and we're worried that the kid is going to be riding on this ox and he's going to be like, you know, jumping around and standing on the ox and he might lean over and then he's not protected by the ox anymore from the tuma coming up, and then it's going to be a problem. And so therefore we put a door there so that the kid will stay in the door. Maybe if you lean over the door, it might tip over. I don't know exactly how it was. But that would keep the kid centered on the ox or centered on the door, or the door was wider than the ox maybe, and that would stop the tumma from infecting the kid.
Could that be why?
It's opposite. I mean, it's saying that Rabbi Yehuda is saying they wouldn't use the door, because the kid would jump around if there was a door there.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that's right. Rabbi Yehuda was specifically saying not the door. Thank you. Sorry. Rabbi Yehuda is saying not the door, and because why? If it was a door,
you have to hold on to.
The ox is going to be holding on. Good. Okay, the door, we're worried he's going to get all... he's going to jump around the door. Good.
Could it be also that they use the door versus using a plywood or some other...
They didn't have plywood then.
Yeah, I'm sure they had something, because a man-made door, I don't know how back then, but I think a door is hollow, so it's made out of two planks of wood with some gap in between. Maybe that could be also the reason they use the door, that it helps something with the tumma?
I don't think so. I think Tosus talks here about the
solid.
Fact that
it was solid.
It wasn't necessarily one plank, but it was planks put next to each other and then nailed together.
The Rishonim talk about the fact that the door itself is a problem, because if the door is a kli, maybe that's going to be makabel tumma. But maybe if it's I think the answer is if it's detached from the ground, so now it's just pshute kliates, right? Generally speaking, we use, you know, for our schach, we could use a piece of, you know, a 2x4 or, you know, a 1x3 or whatever, even though that might in another context be a kli, right? But as long as it's just pshute kliates, as long as it's just straight wood, that's not makabel tumah. So these doors, when they were unattached to. I think Tosus talks about. I think I saw Tosus talks about the fact that the door itself might be a problem. But the bottom line is the fact that it's a just the pshute kliyetz. The fact that it's just straight wood is going to save it from any tumah, and that's why these doors would work. Okay, fine. So now, so Rava was the one who pointed out that they specifically, the Rav Yehuda specifically didn't want the doors because he didn't want the kids hanging over, right? So Tanya Kavasi, the Rava, Rav Yehuda, Omer, Lahayu, Mevi'in, Delasos, Kalikar, they wouldn't use doors at all. Mifnei Shadaito, Shotino, Gasa, Love, because kids are very self-confident. Shema Yotzi, Rosho, Echan, Meivarav, Vitame, Vekever, Atom, and we're worried that with the door, he's going to be jumping around, he's going to stick his head out from the door, and he'll get the tuma from the potential buried body underneath. Rather, Elam Mevi'in Shvarim HaMitzarim Shebekriso Seam Rachavos. Rather, Shvarim HaMitzarim, is that Egyptian Shvarim maybe? Is that how they translate it? Yeah. Shebekriso Seam Rachavos, which are very wide bellies, and that then is bigger than a Mali Egrof, and so it doesn't now violate Rabbi Yehuda's rule. It's bigger than a fist, and it stops the tuma from going up. The kid is entirely protected from the tuma. V'atinokos yoshven al gabeyan, v'kosos shalevin b'yadeyam, the kids would sit on top of the shore, they would have a stone vessel in their hand, when they'd get to the river, yardu, they would get down, umalum, they would fill up the vessel, v'olu, they'd get back on, v'yashvu lehen al gabeyan, and they would go back, and they would go to where the paraduma was prepared. Okay. So that all was by way of introduction. And now the Gemara is going to circle back to the sugya that we're concerned about, which is the sukkah. So we said that Rabbi Yehuda said in the Mishnah that we always used to sleep under beds, and even though they were beds that were more than 10 tefachim, and no one ever complained about it, meaning the Zakenim who saw us doing this never commented on what we were doing, meaning Rabbi Yehuda is taking the position that it's perfectly okay to sleep under a bed within a sukkah. That's not considered a significant interruption to to your status. It's considered as if you're in the sukkah. It's not considered a significant interruption between you and the schach and your yotzei the mitzvah. The Gemara says, "Varimita diesh bam kame grofim." If we're going to apply kind of similar rules to the bed in the sukkah, as we apply to this analysis of Hilchos Tum and Tara, so a mita is clearly bigger than a fist wide, and so in the context of tuma, it would be considered a significant structure to be mafsik the tuma, to interrupt any tuma from below, right? Because as we just saw. And yet, v'tinan Rabbi Yehuda Omer nogim hayinu sheinu yishenim tachas hamita bifnei hazakenim. Rabbi Yehuda said in our Mishnah that it wasn't a problem to sleep under the bed in the Mishnah. Why should that be? If in the context of tumah, anything bigger than a fist is that's even not man-made, and certainly even if it's narrower than a fist, if it's man-made, is a significant structure according to Rabbi Yehuda. So why shouldn't it be considered a significant structure in our Mishnah to interrupt the effect of being in a sukkah, essentially? That's the question. So the Gemara says, Shiny Mita Hoel Ulgaba Asuya. A bed is different than a shore. A bed is different than an ox, because a bed is built for a person to sleep on top of. A normal person sleeps on his bed, not under his bed. And so therefore, since the normal thing, the normal function of a bed is for the person to sleep on top of it, so now if you sleep under it, it's disregarded as a structure. That's the idea. Since the normal way to sleep on a bed is to sleep on top of it, if you're sleeping under a bed, it's disregarded as a structure. So the Gemara answers immediately, Shvarim nami ugaban asuyan. An ox also, you're sitting on top of it typically. And so why would we say then that a shore should be considered a structure to interrupt tumah coming up if a shore also its only function is, or its normal function is for a person to sit on top of it? It's no different than the bed. Basically, we're saying it's no different than the bed. Both of them, a person sits on top of them typically, and yet we seem to be saying by the shore that it interrupts the tumma coming up, whereas the bed doesn't interrupt the status of the person sleeping under it. So the Gemara answer is, so Kiyasa Ravin, Amar Rav Elazar, Shaini Shvarim, Ho Maginim Al Haroim Bechama, Mipnei Chama Uvikshamim Mnei Geshamim. So the Gemara says, when it comes to an ox, the truth is, an ox, one of its functions is for the person sitting on top of the ox, but that's not the only function. Oxen are also useful for if you are out in the field and it starts raining and you have your ox with you, you might duck under your ox to protect yourself from the rain. And in fact, apparently this is what they did. And so one of the normal functions of an ox is not just for sitting on top of the ox, but also for gaining shelter by being under the ox.
That's like Bifnei Chama also. They were,
and to get shade. Right, to get shelter from the sun. And so therefore an ox has a function not only for being on top of the ox, but also for being under the ox. And that's why the ox arguably interrupts the tumma from coming from below, whereas a bed might not, because a bed's primary function is for sleeping on top of it. Where it says, Yachi mita nami, that's also true for a bed. Ho magina al minalim sundalim shetachteha. A bed is useful not only for sleeping on top of it, but if you ever have gone to camp, you put all your shoes under your bed. So a bed is useful for putting stuff under. Rashi points out very interesting here that Dafka uses the example of shoes because you're not supposed to put food under your bed. You're not supposed to put other things under your bed. But shoes you can put under your bed. So it seems like a bed is of the same stature of an ox. An ox is good for things on top of it, like the person riding on the bed, on the ox, and a bed is good for things on top of it. But an ox is also useful for hiding under the ox to get shade or to protect yourself from the rain. And the bed is also useful for storing your shoes under the bed, so it's no different. And so therefore, just like the ox protects from the tumma going up, the bed should be considered a significant structure to interrupt someone sleeping under the bed. Why then does Rabbi Yehuda say that you can be yotzei in the mitzvah of sukkah even if you're sleeping under a bed? A an ox is significant because its structure is kind of inherently built for what's under it, meaning an important primary purpose of the back of the ox, of the spine of the ox, if you could picture it, is to kind of protect on for the intestines, all the innards of the ox that's under it. Shenemar oru basar tal bisheni uvatzamus vaginim tzochicheni. Meaning an ox, the back of the ox, it's kind of primarily built to kind of house or encase the innards, the guts of the ox. And so therefore the ox has that status, whereas a bed isn't quite like that. An ox is all the more so built for what's under it, what's under the back of the ox, more so than the bed. And so therefore the ox is going to, interrupt the tumma that's flowing from under it and protect the kid on top of the ox, whereas the bed, according to Rabbi Yehuda, will not be considered an ohel, will not have that significance, and therefore sleeping under the bed, even if there's 10 tefachim, according to Rabbi Yehuda, is not problematic. V'baisema, another alternative reason is Rabbi Yehuda Taimei, maybe Rabbi Yehuda is consistent with his opinion. We're now we're going to kind of go in a completely different direction and say, the reason why Rabbi Yehuda departs from the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda specifically allows you to sleep under a bed, the reason why Rabbi Yehuda specifically allows you to sleep under a bed is because Rabbi Yehuda was one of those Tanaim on Daf Zion who said, "D'amar sukkah diras keva ba'inan." Right? Generally speaking, we think of one of the primary characteristics of a sukkah is that it's a diras arai, that it's a temporary structure. That was, in fact, that was the very first daf, right? The reason we said, one of the reasons we said why it can't be more than 20 amos tall is because if it's too tall, it's going to have to be built very strong to support its own weight. And that's going to defeat the purpose of sukkah because a sukkah is supposed to be a diras arai. It's supposed to be a temporary structure. That's the whole nature of a sukkah. But then we saw that there are a whole bunch of Tanaim who disagreed with that and, in fact, allowed it to be very tall and said that even if it's not tall, one of the fundamental natures of a sukkah is that it's dafka diras keva. It's kind of counterintuitive, counter what we think about as dira. But there were Tanaim who held that way in Dav Zayin. We had a list of Tanaim, Rashi, or list them, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, Achirim. They all held that a sukkah is supposed to be fundamentally a permanent structure. It's supposed to be built strong. It's supposed to be a diras keva. And so therefore, Rabbi Yehuda was one of those people who held that a sukkah is a permanent structure. V'havale mita diras arai. Whereas a mita clearly is not built as a permanent structure. It's not even a structure at all. It's just a utensil. It's just a mita. It's just a bed. V'sukka, v'havale mita diras arai. V'sukka ohel keva. A sukkah, as we just said, is a permanent structure. V'lo asi ohel arai umavatel ohel keva. And just there's this kind of principle that Rabbi Yehuda latches onto, which is that a impermanent structure should not override a permanent structure. Meaning, the main thing going on here, if you look at the sukkah and review this conception, is that the sukkah is a permanent structure. That's the main star of the show. There's a permanent, well-built, strong sukkah, and that's the nature of a sukkah. And then in it is a bed. If you look at the bed, this is just a flimsy bed. It's just a bed. It's not, doesn't have that permanence of the sukkah. And so we have this kind of principle that if you look at a impermanent diras arai, something that's not very strong in the context of or compared to a very strong, bold sukkah, so the mere fact that that impermanent small structure that's temporary is there shouldn't take away from the power and halachic stature of the diras keva, of the big permanent sukkah. And so since Rabbi Yehuda specifically holds that sukkah has this permanent nature, this permanent character as a diras keva, that's why Rabbi Yehuda is the one who holds that a bed is not going to throw that off balance. It's not going to play any role. It's going to be disregarded in the context of that diras keva. The Gemara then says, "Var Rabbi Shimon, damar nami sukkah diras keva ba'inan." But Rabbi Shimon was one of those Tanaim who held that a sukkah is of a permanent nature, that a sukkah requires a diras keva. And yet in our Mishnah, Rabbi Shimon sided with the Chachamim to say, remember, he was the one who brought the evidence from Tabi, Rabbi Gamliel's slave. He was the one who, Rabbi Shimon sided with the Chachamim who said that a sukkah, that you can't sleep under the bed. So if Rabbi Shimon holds, just like Rabbi Yehuda, that a sukkah is a diras keva, shouldn't he attack this with the same analysis that transitory diras arai of a bed shouldn't overpower the strong diras keva of a sukkah? So the Gemara answer is b'ha pligi. Mar savra asi ol arai umvata ol keva. Mar savra asi ol arai umvata ol keva. The Gemara says that's exactly what they're arguing about. Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda are arguing about whether that principle is true, that when you have a diras keva, a permanent structure, it should be susceptible of being uprooted and overtaken by a impermanent structure like a bed, or not. Or maybe it's because the sukkah, as we said, is so permanent, we disregard the impermanent bed that's below it. Good. Then just one little snippet till we get to the next Mishnah. Amar Rabbi Shimon, Maisa B'Tavi Avda. Remember, we said in the Mishnah that Rabbi Shimon brought his evidence from the fact that Tavi wasn't purposely Mekayim the mitzvah of Sukkah, or as Tosfos explained, volunteered to sleep under the bed in order to make more room for the Chachamim. But the point is that that we learned the Salaka from Tavi. So Tanya, Amar Rabbi Shimon, Mishichaso. Amar Rabbi Shimon. From Rabbi Gamliel's conversation, from Rabbi Gamliel's telling over about the actions of his slave, we learn two things. One thing we learn is that avadim are pater from sukkah. Now, Tosos here asks, that's not a chiddush at all. In Kol HaTarakula, everyone knows that avadim are pater from mitzvah seishah zman grama. And sukkah is a classic mitzvah seishah zman grama. It's a time-bound mitzvah. So why would you need Rabbi Gamliel to teach you? Or why would you learn this halacha from a casual conversation or a casual remark of Rabbi Gamliel, we know that that an eved is pater from sukkah. Tosfos answers that in fact on Daf Chaf Ches we're going to have the same question, because on Daf Chaf Ches the Gemara is going to say that halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, women are paturin from sukkah. The Gemara is going to say, what are you talking about? Halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, women are paturin from sukkah. It's fundamental now. Everyone knows that women are pater mitzvah because of the mitzvah seisha zman grama. There are a million other mitzvahs that women are pater from because of the mitzvah seisha zman grama. So why are you going out of your way to teach me this like fundamental rule that mitzvah that women are pater from sukkah? And so the same question presents itself here. What is a casual comment of Rabbi Gamliel? That's the source for the fact that that slaves are pater from sukkah. And the Gemara there explains that there's a havamina. Actually, two havaminas in the Gemara there. One is that by sukkah, we know that from the pasuk it's teishvu kein taduru. The mitzvahs of sukkah, the way that we are mekayim the mitzvah of sukkah, is fashioned after the way we would normally live in a house. So just like when you live in your house, your wife lives in your house with you, and we don't say that it's mitzvah as man government alone in a house, and women don't, you know, women live in a house. That's the way you live in a house. So if our living in a sukkah should be modeled after how we live in a house, you should live in your sukkah with your wife. And maybe that would then be an exception to mitzvah seisha as mangram, and women would be in fact mechuyavos in sukkah. Comes along halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai to teach you, no, women are not mechuyavos in sukkah. So here too, you might have thought that you live in your house with your slave. Your slave is with you in your house, so maybe slaves are mechuyav in the mitzvah of sukkah. Comes along Rabbi Gamliel, and casual from his casual comment, we learn that avadim p'turim in sukkah. So that's number one. And we learn, as we saw, that you're not yotzei the mitzvah of sukkah if you sleep under a bed. So why is it specifically, right, a few lines above, it says, from kind of the conversation of Rabbi Gamliel, from the casual comment of Rabbi Gamliel, why does it phrase it that way? Why doesn't it phrase it midvar of Shavuot Gamliel? A more common way to explain this would be from the sayings of Rabbi Gamliel, from what Rabbi Gamliel told us. We learned this. So the Gemara answer is mil saag of urche kamashman. It's teaching us a lesson. Ki adam rav acha bar adav, amr rav rav acha bar adav, marav, hamnuna, marav, they said in the name of Rav, minayin shafil sichas tamidei chamim tzricha limud. How do you know that you have to delve into and analyze even the casual comments of the conversation of Talmud Chacham, Shenemar Valeu Lo Yibol? The pasuk in Tehillim is talking about how Limud Torah is like a tree that gives off fruit. And the pasuk, it's right, Ke'etz Shasul Al Palge Mayim Asher Piryo Yitein Be'ito, and then it says Valeu Lo Yibol, its leaves will not wither. The idea is that even its leaves, even the most inconsequential parts of a tree, are like learning Torah. Or I should say Torah is like learning. Torah is compared to even the inconsequential parts of the tree, even the leaves, which are, you know, can wither away. So too, a Talmud Chacham who speaks and says over something even casually, you should delve into and try to learn something from that. And so that's why Rabbi Shimon phrased it as misichaso shel Rabbi Gamliel, from the casual conversation of Rabbi Gamliel, we learn these halachas, and not from the sayings of Rabbi Gamliel, to teach us that even the casual conversation of a Talmud Chacham is worthy of delving into and learning lessons from. Okay, shkoyach.